Are you a wayward woman? Might you be guilty of a morality crime? What are you doing out here at this hour anyway? Perhaps we should just keep you right here for your own safety. Have a seat and let's listen to best-selling author Amy Stewart tell us about her newest book, Miss Cop's Midnight Confessions, and the real women who inspired it. I'm your host, Emma Brecon, and that's what we're talking about on Through the Eyes of Women, right here and now on KHSU. Welcome to Through the Eyes of Women, a program about the lives and perspectives of women local, national, and international. Best-selling author Amy Stewart won many of our hearts when she gave us the idea of cocktail gardening. She also writes about bugs, co-owns a bookstore, and paints. Her latest venture is the third book of the Cop Sisters series, based on the actual lady sheriffs of a century ago. Hi, Amy. Welcome to Through the Eyes of Women.
Hello. Good to be here.
This is the third book of a very popular series. First of all, how does that feel?
Oh, it's been great. It's, you know, I've really fell in love with these women. And so it's so nice that other people love them like I do.
Who are the Cop Sisters?
Yeah, so these are three sisters who lived 100 years ago in Hackensack, New Jersey. And I stumbled across their story completely by accident while I was doing research for Drunken Botanist. And this happens all the time. You know, you're doing research for one thing and something else just turns up maybe on the same page of the newspaper or whatever. So I'm used to that happening. And usually you sort of have to go, well, that's fascinating and weird, but I really need to set this aside and get back to work. But in this case, I was so interested in this story that I kept digging and I kept reading. And the more I found, the more I thought, wow, this is a really incredible story. It could make a great novel, and not just one, but a series of novels. So let me just tell you what happened. 100 years ago, these three sisters were out riding in their horse and buggy in Paterson, New Jersey, and a guy hit them with his automobile. This is early days of automobiles. They got into a dispute over payment for the damage to their buggy, and that escalated a conflict until they were getting shots fired at their house, arson attempts, kidnapping threats. I mean, they basically had a car accident with the wrong guy. And so they spent a year where they were basically under siege and really being harassed by this guy.
And these are the victims of the accident.
Yeah, right. But astonishingly, they really stood up to him and really fought back. The sheriff issued them revolvers in case he came around again. Could you imagine if this happened today? Like, you're being harassed, you're afraid for your life, and you call the police, and they bring you guns and teach you how to shoot. Like, that would never happen. But that's what happened. And as a result of, especially the eldest sister, Constance, as a result of her work in trying to catch this guy and see him convicted, the sheriff was so impressed with what she did that he offered her a job as deputy sheriff. And this was remarkable because there were very few women in law enforcement at that time.
Do you remember what that first tidbit that you saw that drew you off of the project you were actually working on was?
Yeah, the first article I ran across was the court case at the end of that year where they are bringing the guy to trial for harassing them. Fortunately, he had used the mail to send threatening letters, so that makes it a federal crime. So it was, you know, it was a pretty big case, and that's why the New York Times was covering it. So the nice thing about that first article is that it really succinctly summarized everything that had happened that first year. So it was almost like a plot summary of the first book in the series, which is Girl Waits with Gun. So Girl Waits with Gun is the first one. And that is a newspaper headline about that first year. It's a newspaper account of a night when Constance stood on a street corner with a gun in her handbag to try to catch the guy.
How historical are these stories? Is there a line between the history and the fiction? How do you approach it?
Yeah, well, you know, this is something everyone handles differently who writes historical fiction. But what I decided to do was that if it really happened, it's in the book. And I'm using fiction to fill in the gaps where I can't possibly know what happened. So, you know, I don't know what they talked about at home. I don't know why people did some of the things they did. So I had to invent some of that, but I am telling their real story as much as I can tell it. And that's going to be true going forward in all the books in this series. You know, after the first one came out, some people said to me, oh, you're writing a sequel, so I guess it's all fiction now. And I'm like, are you kidding me? Like, they didn't die at the end of the book. They went on to do more amazing things. I have years worth of amazing things they did that I want to write about.
Is there an ethos if you're going to be putting words into somebody's mouth or inventing a conversation that occurs behind closed doors that you weren't privy to? Do you have any guidelines for yourself?
Well, I mean, what I try to do is I try to really think about what speech was like at that time. So I'm very particular about the language. I tend to read a lot from the 1910s. Novels and newspaper articles and memoirs, letters, even like transcripts of conferences where people were just speaking extemporaneously. That's been very helpful. So I am trying to be very particular about the language, but of course it is fiction. So I'm inventing what they're saying and why and how they're saying it. There's no way around that.
So historical fiction, fiction based on real people. And a lot of what you happen to have written has been, do we call it nonfiction? What do we call it? You've written about bugs, plants, cocktails,
yes,
gardening, memoirs.
Right.
And so do you distinguish? Is there a different approach to what you're doing with the Cop Sisters, or is it all just creativity and fun?
I mean, the big difference, of course, apart from the fact that I get to make stuff up now, which I couldn't do before, the big difference is that I am no longer writing in Amy Stewart's voice.
Ah.
So that is very nice, because I am sick of listening to that woman talk. So the less of that, the better. So, you know, I mean, the first two books in this series are written in the first person from Constance's point of view. So it's her voice and her language, which is different from mine. So that's been very liberating. It's really nice to not just be stuck with the voice in my own head.
You've got some pretty strong themes in your book, so I thought it would be fun to start out asking you, what is a wayward woman?
Yes. Well, this is something that actually really struck me as soon as I started researching the Cop Sisters and sort of what women were up to at that time, is that this is an era when women were being arrested for crimes like waywardness, moral degradation, incorrigibility. These were all words to describe charges against women.
They all sound pretty subjective.
Right, very subjective. And some of this came about, it had been happening earlier, but it sort of got codified and made official when the Mann Act passed in the early 20th century, M-A-N-N, named after the senator who brought the law forward. And it was a good law in some ways intended to fight sex trafficking. And in fact, the Mann Act is still in effect today for that reason. But the Mann Act made it a crime to transport a woman across state lines for an immoral purpose. So
no further details or
right,
subparagraphs, just immoral purposes.
Yes. So two people who weren't married to each other, maybe getting on the ferry in Fort Lee, New Jersey, and going across to Manhattan.
Suddenly, for dinner.
For whatever. Yeah, they have committed a crime. So this was a big deal. And, you know, the other thing that's going on right at this time is that women are growing up and going into the workforce in a way that they hadn't really before. You know, now we had factories that girls could go work in and offices, maybe leaving the house, maybe wanting to live on their own. And it was very sort of terrifying to people that young women were going to be out in the world with no chaperones, no one to watch over them. And there were places, this was new, that there were places where men and women could gather together. You know, we don't talk about this much, but women used to live in a very segregated world. We weren't allowed in restaurants and bars and clubhouses. There were a lot of public places where we could not go. So segregation was a very real thing for women. And suddenly we had movie theaters and amusement palaces and restaurants that women were admitted to. And suddenly women were just out on their own unsupervised. And that was terrifying. So you could get locked up for that. And parents would call the police on their daughters and say, she's wayward.
They're adult daughters.
They're adult or sometimes teenagers. I mean, you know, sometimes as young as 14, 15, 16. But they would say, we can't control her. She's out every night. She's not bringing her wages home to us anymore. She's out there spending her own money or spending some man's money. And girls and young women were getting locked up for years over this stuff in state reformatories with no due process. This was long before you have a right to an attorney, and if you can't afford one, one will be appointed for you. We didn't have any of that. So they would not have any representation.
I thought it was interesting when you were pitching the example of the couple taking a ferry from New Jersey to Manhattan. You said they have committed a crime. And I'm sure that's how it was treated. But I think it's interesting. This is a law preventing the transportation of women. So that puts her in a passive role. If she's being transported and needs this law to protect her, how is she guilty of a crime, Amy Stewart?
Yeah, right. I mean, that's such an interesting thing about this moment in time, is that there was this idea that women must be the unwitting victims in all of this. We have to assume that, because no good, proper woman would want to allow herself to be degraded in such a way. And there was this myth, and this also comes up in these books, there was this myth in the 1910s about white slavery. And the term white slavery was used to mean women who had been captured and kidnapped and drugged and dragged into prostitution, forced into prostitution. So that's what that term meant at that time. And the idea was no woman would voluntarily enter into prostitution. It couldn't possibly be a choice. The only way a woman could become a prostitute would be that she was drugged. She woke up the next day in a home of ill repute. She has already been, quote unquote, ruined by some men, and had no choice then, because of the shame and what had happened to her, to remain in prostitution. So there was this weird idea that women can't possibly have agency and can't possibly be making these decisions. They must be being drugged or tricked or conned. But then on the other hand, women were being locked up for their bad behavior, sometimes for years, because they were seen as posing a threat to men. We have to get this morally corrupt woman off the streets. She's terrible.
So literally locked up in literal jail or some kind?
Yes, real jail. Oh, yeah. Real jail and real reformatory homes, which were very rough places to go. This was not a nice place to go, very much like juvenile hall today. And, you know, there are lots of cases of girls who were arrested when they were 14 and locked up until they were 21 with no way to get out. And sometimes their parents would even come to regret what they'd done and want them back. Like, the parents would come to the courts and say, you know what, we're moving out of state and we don't want to just leave her here. And they would be like, hey man, she was sentenced. You were all on board with this when we locked her up. You can't just come get her whenever you want. So yeah, women were really deprived of their civil liberties. And you may be wondering what happened with the men in these cases.
Yes. I am. These men who were transporting these women across state lines, breaking the law that was meant to protect them.
Yes, it takes two to tango. But, you know, they very often had lawyers, could afford to hire a lawyer, had resources. But also they were not seen by the courts as being morally corrupted. It was assumed that, like, well, of course, a man is going to take what opportunities are offered to him. We can't really blame. He is not a menace to society. He is not a threat to virtuous womanhood. It is women who are luring men into these situations, and who, by the way, are also spreading diseases. So one reason to lock women up is that at that time, sexually transmitted diseases were not treatable. So it was a terrifying thing to catch one. We were about to go into World War I, where all of our young men were going to be needed to go fight. And we could not send them over there if they had diseases. And so the way to stop that from happening would be to lock up women who might be at risk of spreading those diseases around.
Wow.
Yeah.
And what are some examples of some actual morality crimes that could get a respectable lady locked up 100 years ago?
Well, I mean, I can tell you about a couple that are in the book. Do we want to just go there?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. So the third book is called Miss Cop's Midnight Confessions, and this is one where I really focused on this issue. So I took two cases that Constance really worked on as deputy sheriff. The only thing I did that's fiction is I mushed them together in time so they could kind of overlap. And then, of course, I did have to fill in all the gaps of the things I didn't know about these girls. But one girl was named Edna Hustis. She was 18. And her crime was that she left home and went and got a job in a munitions factory making ammunition for the war, and rented a room for herself in a boarding house. Like, that's all she did. And she was 18 years old. And her mother went to the police to say that she was wayward. and that she needed to be arrested and brought back home. And Constance intervened and said, there is nothing wrong with what she's doing, and it's terrible of her mother to want to try to keep her at home, and really defended her and defended her right to go out and get a job. But this is something that people in law enforcement were expected to spend their time on. So that's like one extreme where it's just sort of absurd. And thank goodness we had someone in a position to say it was absurd and sort it all out, because no one otherwise was really going to put the time into sorting any of it out. But the other case is a little more extreme. It's a girl named Minnie Davis who left home and ran off with a guy who worked on a steamboat going up and down the Hudson River. And so she really did like run away and go to live with a man that she isn't married to, which was considered a much bigger deal at that time.
For sure.
Right. But still, Constance, even though she sort of voluntarily chose to go do this thing, you know, Constance is still trying to figure out a way to protect her and defend her and have her not get locked up for, you know, 5 or 6 years over this. And actually, getting locked up was not the end of it, because once you got out of the reform house, you were still on probation, which meant that a probation officer had to approve where you worked, where you lived, and who you married. You could not get married without their permission.
Your probation officer?
Yeah, yeah. So women were deprived of their liberty far long after they were released from jail. They weren't just free to go.
Oh, Amy Stewart. You're listening to Through the Eyes of Women. I am your host, Emma Bracon, and we're talking to Amy Stewart about her latest book, Miss Cops, Midnight Confessions, and the real people who inspired it. And you actually have an opportunity to see and hear a lot more about this on Saturday night at the Eureka Theater. Amy, would you like to tell us what you have in store for us?
Yes. So this is going to be during Arts Alive at the Eureka Theater at 7 o'clock. I am going to give a talk, and I have pictures of the real people who are in these books and the real places where they lived and worked and where all this stuff happened. So I'm going to give a talk about that, and we'll have, you know, books for sale and treats to eat and drink and all that good stuff.
What kind of treats to drink, Amy?
Well, they do very well with their cocktails at the Eureka Theater. We actually do have a drink that goes with every book, and I haven't actually asked them yet if they are going to do that one or not. But it's called the Midnight, and it is a real drink from that era.
Well, for goodness sake, what's in it?
Yeah, so the Midnight, it's an interesting drink. It's gin and sweet vermouth and a little orange juice. I think there's also dry vermouth. And then a drop of absinthe. So it's very close to what's called a Bronx cocktail. If it had orange bitters instead of absinthe, it would be a Bronx, which is a little bit more famous. But it's quite a tasty drink. If you like absinthe, it's quite a tasty drink.
All right. Good to know. Noted. So have you always been attracted to this time period that you're writing in for the Cop Sisters?
You know, yes, I think the 1910s are a very interesting time because it's not yet the 20s. And we all see the 20s on TV and movies, and we've heard a lot about the 20s. But the 1910s, it's still very much the Victorian era, definitely in terms of kind of morality and how we organize society, but also dress. Technology has not quite started to really change the world the way it's about to. So people sort of just barely had telephones. Some people had cars, but like not even all the roads could accommodate. Well, none of the roads could accommodate cars at first. So it's very like disruptive technology. Like here come cars. And then you have cities and counties saying, well, should we rebuild all the roads or just some of the roads or like none of the roads? Like how long is this car thing even going to last? Is it going to be around forever? So it's just a really interesting time where things are kind of just about to really change, but they haven't yet.
Amy, are you a wayward woman? Would you be locked up in your books?
Well, you know, I certainly would have been locked up when I was unmarried. We can say that.
So we get a lot of shielding and protection and legitimacy from marriage. That's true, huh?
That's right. Yeah, we did back in the day.
I wanted to ask you, you are touring right now, talking about your third book in the series. Is it true the fourth is already written and in the can?
Yes, the fourth book is done. I turned it in right before I left on tour, so I will get it back with some edits, you know, when I get finished with all this travel. So it should be out a year from now. If with any luck, I'll keep doing these at that pace, you know, a book a year. But it sounds kind of crazy every time I say that. I'm not quite sure how we're pulling this off. So we'll see.
Would you like to just give us a little hint on what you're going to be addressing in book number four?
We were just talking the other day, me and my publisher, about exactly how are we going to talk about this book. And here's why. The day I sat down to start writing this book, and I always start in November when I'm home from tour. So I've tried to map it out and plan it and think about it. But then that's when I really have to start writing. The day I sat down to write it was November 9th, 2016. And the book is very much about a bruising election season in which a woman is the target of misogynist, sexist attacks.
Fascinating.
Yes.
Work of fiction. Tell us more.
Yeah. It was quite a thing to have to sit down and start grappling with the election of 1916 when I was so freshly grappling with the election of 2016. So that was my winner last winter.
And what got you through it? I know how a lot of other people are getting themselves through that.
I'll tell you what got me through it, especially over the winter, which I would call sort of the acute phase, right, for all of us. But what got me through is, first of all, I did have work to do. You know, I had this book and I'm home in the winter and I'm writing 1,000 words a day every day. And that's my routine. And so I really stuck with it and I stuck with work. And I made sure to get some exercise. And I started doing two new things for my own sanity. And one was I started learning Italian. Just on my walks, there's this great Italian learning podcast. And so for 30 minutes, I'd go out and I'd exercise really hard and I'd be learning Italian, which meant I couldn't really think about anything else because it's like just hard enough that you have to pay attention. And I also started taking more art classes. So every day I would take there's some great art classes online and I would just sit down and do a little art lesson. And again, it was just about trying to not freak out so much and trying to have something else to do. So making art was really helpful. And what I would do is I made more art over the winter than I have in a long time. And then I would sell it and give 100% of the money to charities that are out there doing really good work that the world needs right now.
And this is leading into exactly what I wanted to ask you about your creativity, because you're not, quote, just, unquote, a writer. You also paint and garden and develop your own artisan cocktails and do paintings of people reading, and you run a bookstore or co-own a bookstore. Do you have a philosophy about your creativity and its outlets, or are you just making it happen?
Well, you know, here's what I guess I'll say about that. I am very disciplined. I'm very structured. So like I said earlier, you know, 1,000 words a day when I'm home writing those books, like I love having small, measurable goals that I can get done. And I'm all about that. I tend to take a big, overwhelming task and I just break it down into like 30 minutes a day or 1,000 words a day or a something, right? So that's like how I do everything, is that it's very structured. But I'll also say that the thing, I think we're in this era now where everybody looks at the cool thing you do and says, oh, that should be a business. Like suddenly everything has to be a business. Everything has to be a side hustle. And the problem with especially doing art or any creative work for a living is that pretty soon you're spending a lot of time. Most of your time is spent doing things like answering emails. I am a professional email answerer. I spent all morning answering emails before I came to see you today. So there is something wonderful about making art that has no possible income earning potential with it, because then it's just for the fun of it and that baggage doesn't come along with it.
Did you always mean to use your writing to explore these big issues that we've been talking about?
You know, I mean, I don't know about always. You know, I wanted to be a writer my whole life, and I'm not quite sure I really thought about what that meant or what I was exploring, but I have to be very interested in the thing in order to write about it, because you sort of have to get married to it, right? You have to really live with it, and you have to put up with it even when it's boring or not working out very well. You got to stick with it. So it is very much like a marriage in that way. So I have to pick things that I'm really interested in or passionate about, or I wouldn't get through the hard parts.
I also wanted to ask you, Amy, there's a lot of great writers out there who are not bestsellers. And I'm wondering if you have any theories on what people are responding to in these books that's just making them so very beloved and popular.
Well, I mean, I don't know. Especially right now, it's hard for me to say why anyone picks up the books they do. What I'm trying to do is to sort of walk a line between historical fiction and crime fiction. I mean, even though Constance is a deputy sheriff and her sisters do get involved and will be involved even more in future books with detective work and law enforcement and crime fighting, they're not about solving cases. They're more about the worlds that these women get into. And I was very inspired by sort of the great era of television that we're in right now. You know, you look at a show like The Wire that is very thematic from season to season. And I wanted to do that with these books. So all I can say is I think that that's interesting to readers because it's not as cookie cutter. It's more like, now we're going to deal with these morality crimes. Now, you know, the next book we're going to get inside an insane asylum. So, you know, we're sort of moving through different worlds that maybe people don't know as much about.
Well, it's the worlds and the times, I think.
Yeah, right.
And what about the echoes in present day? For instance, when you're talking about these morality crimes and women being locked up, there's lots of parts of planet Earth in 2017 where this stuff is still happening.
Including the United States. So here's the thing. I just got an email from a retired probation officer who read the third one, Miss Copp's Midnight Confessions, which is where Constance is dealing with this stuff. And she said, you know, this is still going on today. There are still today girls who get locked up over this kind of behavior, and it's their parents doing it. She actually said, you know, I have been saying for years that boys never get locked up for sex unless they're gay. Seriously. And girls do. So she is still seeing girls being disproportionately punished for sexual behavior or for just asserting a particular kind of independence, whereas boys tend to be more locked up for like violent crimes. So some of this stuff hasn't changed at all. I mean, there are girls today who would have stories very similar to Edna's and Minnie's right now. This is happening in our country.
Well, Amy, I just want to thank you for coming in, taking the time to talk to us about your new book, Miss Copp's Midnight Confessions. Would you like to remind us one more time what we get to expect Saturday night during Arts Alive at the Eureka Theater?
Yes. So I'll be at the Eureka Theater at 7. Saturday night during Arts Alive, I'm going to give a talk with slides that show the real people in these books and the real places where they lived. And then I'll be signing books and we'll have drinks and all kinds of good stuff.
And people get to hang with you and ask their own little personal questions about your books?
Yes, exactly.
Well, that's fantastic of you, Amy. I might run out the back door. I don't know.
Okay.
But anyway, I want to thank you very much for being on Through the Eyes of Women.
Thank you.
And have a great event on Saturday.
Okay, thanks.
You've been listening to Through the Eyes of Women. I've been your host, Emma Brakan, and I've been speaking with Amy Stewart. For more information, visit amystewart.com. Through the Eyes of Women is produced for KHSU, located at Humboldt State University. Thanks to today's engineer and editor, Katie Whiteside, and to our entire production team. You can listen to this show again anytime in Through the Eyes of Women's permanent blog archives. Visit our blog at khsuwomen.com and join us again next Monday at 1:30 right here on KHSU. HSU.